we have an article that'll be coming out either today or Monday about this that looks at the DeWine administration's response to this, looks at the DeWine administration's connections to Norfolk Southern. And we really hope that we're definitely going to continue down this path of looking into why exactly this controlled release happened, and which in and of itself is a propagandistic term. You know, it was a massive chemical burn. It wasn't really a controlled release.
And let's remember that they didn't even release Norfolk Southern what the chemicals were: carcinogenic benzene, vinyl chloride, that is, phosgene was a chemical weapon in World War I.
Yep.
For more than a week after the derailment happened, what was it, right in the middle of, on the day of football.
Yes. Yeah.
Of the Super Bowl.
And these, as folks, any chemical expert will tell you, also when these chemicals interact with each other, they can, create new chemicals, and that modeling has not been released about how exactly this interacts with other chemicals that are naturally occurring in the environment, with other chemicals that were on the railroad that were released. We don't know. We don't know what the effect was at all.
And finally, we haven't even mentioned the News Nation reporter, Evan Lambert, who's with National Association of Black Journalists and News Nation, arrested, taken down on the ground as he reported from a DeWine news conference.
Yes. Yeah, no, I was saying on another media appearance that it reminds me of my other experiences with logistics reporting, is that the logistics system in the U.S. is highly militarized. The railroads have the only fully privatized police force in the country. In this case, the reporter got into an argument with the state's adjutant general, the head of the National Guard, and it really appears like that argument immediately devolved into a fairly violent arrest of a reporter. As far as I understand, the last time I checked, those charges against Evan Lambert, this reporter, for disorderly conduct, still haven't been dropped.
I think they have been dismissed.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Well, Matthew Cunningham Cook, I want to thank you so much for being with us, researcher and writer for The Lever. We're going to link to the pieces of The Lever that's done an extraordinary job exposing what's going on in East Palestine, Ohio. Well, from East Palestine to Palestine, next up, we speak with Jim Cavallaro, the prominent human rights attorney. Last week, the Biden administration nominated him for a top human rights post and withdrew the nomination, due in part to his criticism of Israel's human rights record. Back in less than 30 seconds.
The king of the wasteland.
Wasteland by Terry Cloth Mother. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Leaders in the human rights world are criticizing the Biden administration for withdrawing the nomination of a prominent human rights attorney from a post over the attorney's past comments criticizing Israel. Last Friday, the State Department announced the nomination of James Cavallaro to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. He'd previously served on the commission from 2014 to 2017, including a period as its president. This was all during the Obama administration, the Obama-Biden administration. Cavallaro is a widely respected human rights attorney, co-founder and executive director of the University Network for Human Rights. Earlier this week, the State Department withdrew Cavallaro's nomination after reports emerged he described Israel as an apartheid state and had criticized House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries' close ties to AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. This is State Department spokesperson Ned Price speaking Tuesday.
His statements clearly do not reflect U.S. policy. They are not a reflection of what we believe, and they are inappropriate, to say the least. We have decided to withdraw our nomination of this individual to withdraw his nomination to serve on the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights.
The Biden administration's decision to withdraw James Cavallaro's nomination has sparked outrage within the human rights community. Agnes Callamard, the secretary general of Amnesty International, condemned what she called a, quote, state-driven attack on a brilliant human rights lawyer because of his view on Israel apartheid. She went on to say, quote, the U.S. government has not engaged with the legal and empirical basis of positions on Israel apartheid. Instead, it's censoring, shutting down debates and threatening, she said. Omar Shakir, who's the Israel and Palestine director of Human Rights Watch, said the move, quote, suggests that for the State Department believing that Palestinians deserve basic rights disqualifies one from serving on a human rights body. Shameful and yet U.S. foreign policy in a nutshell, he said. James Cavallaro has become just the latest figure to lose or risk losing a position due to his criticism of Israel. Last year, the dean at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government vetoed a fellowship for former Human Rights Watch executive director Kenneth Roth over his criticism of Israel's human rights record. Under public pressure, Harvard recently reversed its decision, and Ken Roth is at Harvard Kennedy School now. We're joined now by James Cavallaro in Los Angeles, where he's visiting professor at the UCLA School of Law, also teaches human rights at Wesleyan University. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jim. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you explain what happened? First, they're praising you, and then they are withdrawing your nomination from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that you had previously served as president of.
Yeah, it really was quite a turn of events, and many thanks for having me on your program, Amy. So on Friday, State Department publicly announced that they had chosen me after an internal process to be the U.S. national candidate to serve as an independent expert. And let me underscore that. It's quite important. As an independent expert on the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and as you noted, I had the privilege of serving on the Inter-American Commission in the past as a result of the nomination of the then Obama-Biden administration. So on Friday, they issue a statement. They talk about my background, my knowledge of Latin America, my fluency in other languages, et cetera, all factors in their choosing me to be the candidate. That's Friday. On Monday, I'm contacted by a reporter for a small outlet who has gone through my Twitter account and pulled up tweets of mine critical of Israeli governmental policies that amount to apartheid, and also critical of the role of money in politics, in particular through AIPAC and its donations to candidates, who then in turn, unfortunately, I would say provide cover or reduce or eliminate any oversight by the United States government that contributes $4 billion a year to Israel of its human rights record. As a result of those tweets, there's some internal debate within state and maybe above state. This is, again, on Monday, the journalist contacts me, contacts State Department, publishes an article, I think, Monday afternoon. On Tuesday morning, I'm called by folks at the State Department and then by the ambassador to the Organization of American States and informed that the State Department is withdrawing my nomination. And it's made clear to me that it's because of the tweets and the statements that you indicated about my characterization of the situation in Israel and Palestine as apartheid, and the critique of the role of AIPAC funding in U.S. politics. Let me underscore two things, if I could, Amy. First, the role of a commissioner on the Inter-American Commission is not as representative of the United States, if you're a U.S. national, or representative of Mexico, if you're a Mexican national, and so forth, for the states of the Americas. It's as an independent expert. The reason why they chose me is because for 3+ decades, I have been an independent analyst expert. I've documented human rights primarily in Latin America, but also in other parts of the world, including Israel and Palestine. That's the first important point. And the second important point is that the decision here, what it in effect does is it requires loyalty to a U.S. position on what's happening in Israel and Palestine that is totally out of sync with what every major human rights organization has said, but notwithstanding it being out of sync, it is now, in effect, a requirement, not just for service within the U.S. government, but for service as an independent expert. And the last thing I would say is, my view is based on my observation, my visits to Israel and Palestine are entirely consistent with the views of Ken Roth, who was on your program when his fellowship was rescinded by the Kennedy School and then reversed, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the leading Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, Al-Haq, the Harvard Human Rights Program, and others who have documented what a human rights activist and practitioner and scholar and expert does is document conditions, compare those conditions to international human rights standards, and call out violations. And you can't pick and choose states. Nobody gets a free pass. The U.S. doesn't get a free pass. Israel doesn't get a free pass. The Palestinian Authority doesn't get a free pass. Egypt, you could go on. No one gets a free pass. That's human rights documentation. That's what it has to be.
You mentioned Ken Roth, the former executive director at Human Rights Watch for almost 30 years. He tweeted about your case saying, quote, Biden's dropping of a candidate for a Latin American human rights post because he criticizes the Israeli government's apartheid, a completely mainstream position for any human rights defender, suggests that only Israeli apologists are acceptable, Roth said. And again, as you said, then we did the last month, the Harvard Kennedy School restored Ken Roth's fellowship after initially rescinding it over his criticism of Israeli human rights abuses. He appeared on Democracy Now! To warn against the chilling effect of Harvard's initial decision.
This is a very serious problem. I mean, it's not just a problem for me personally. This is not, you know, impeding my career in a significant way. But I think about, you know, first of all, the younger academics who don't have, you know, the visibility that I do, who are going to take from this lesson the view that if you touch Israel, if you criticize Israel, that can be a career-killing move. You'll get canceled. And that's a disastrous signal to send.
To see that whole interview, you can go to democracynow.org. And again, he's now at the Harvard Kennedy School because there was such international outcry. Harvard caved and reoffered him the position. But now I want to ask you, Jim Cavallaro, about Sarah Margon, who was nominated to serve as Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor. And then she came under intense criticism from Senate Republicans, most notably Jim Risch of Idaho, for past tweets purportedly showing she supported BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, let me first say that Ken made an interesting point about young academics. We're seeing right now the unfair pressures that Professor Lara Sheehy is suffering at George Washington University. Because of her defense of the rights of Palestinians, she's facing, I think, spurious accusations. And she's under a significant amount of pressure. So let me just say that what Ken is talking about is quite real. And I, like Ken perhaps more because of his stature in the field of human rights, I have a platform. I have associations with leading institutions, Wesleyan University. I teach at Yale Law School. I teach at UCLA. I teach at Columbia Law School. And
you're
still,
a long-time
this has
professor
been
at Stanford
a really difficult
Law.
Experience.
Long-time professor at Stanford Law School. So what do you do now? I mean, again,
yes, I also taught at Harvard and Stanford Law Schools. Thank you. But so what, the other, I'm sorry, Amy, the other question you had was about Sarah Margon, no?
Yes.
So I'm sorry, but just to complete with her, you have a situation where, again, her stated positions, working for Human Rights Watch on Israel and Palestine don't square with U.S. foreign policy, which, again, is out of line. The view of the United States is a non-mainstream view. It is an extreme view. It is not the majority view of those who have documented conditions in Israel and Palestine. And it's probably worth flagging here, if I could, what we're talking about. There's a legal definition of apartheid. It's domination by one group, one racial group or ethnic group, over another. And that is quite clear in terms of land confiscations, in terms of expansions of settlements, in terms of the building permits that are denied to Palestinians, voting rights that are denied to Palestinians, freedom of movement that is denied to Palestinians, which highway you could be on. You can't be on them if you're Palestinian. You can't get a building permit. The situation in Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. Human Rights Watch put out a dense report documenting this. So did Amnesty. So have other groups. But with Sarah Margon, her position was to serve within state, but with a focus on human rights. That person should be a human rights expert. That's problematic when there's a litmus test on Israel and Palestine, which is not consistent with human rights, which is required in order to serve. It's honestly even more concerning when it's a litmus test as well to serve as an independent expert. I would not have represented the United States government, and I would have had absolutely no remit over Israel and Palestine. The Inter-American Commission oversees human rights in the Western Hemisphere. That's the other hemisphere, Israel and Palestine. So the expansion, unfortunately, of the areas in which one has to abide by U.S. policy, even as a human rights activist, even in Latin America, is really, really concerning.
Well, we're going to continue to follow this. Jim Cavallaro, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor at Wesleyan, visiting professor at UCLA School of Law. Before that, taught at Harvard, at Stanford Law School for many years. The Biden administration just withdrew his nomination to serve on the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which he already served on from 2014 to 2017 and was president of for a period of that time. Next up, we speak with the Brazilian indigenous leader about Lula's trip to Washington and Bolsonaro committing genocide in the Amazon. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Guzman. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was in Washington last week meeting with President Biden, talking about the climate crisis and preserving the Amazon. The meeting came just over a month after supporters of Brazil's former leader, Jair Bolsonaro, attempted a coup shortly after Lula's inauguration. This week, Bolsonaro announced he plans to return to Brazil to lead the opposition. Last week, I spoke to Davi Kopanawa Yanomami, a leader and shaman for the Yanomami people, one of the largest indigenous tribes in Brazil. While he was in Washington, D.C., while Lula was meeting with Biden, the Brazilian government recently expelled thousands of illegal gold miners from Yanomami land. In January, Lula visited with the Yanomami people and accused Bolsonaro's government of committing genocide. I asked Davi Kopanawa Yanomami about Lula and the plight of the Yanomami people.
Hey,
the people from the city, the non-indigenous society, are listening to what I have to say. You asked me, what does President Lula represent? For me, my people, the indigenous people of Brazil, he has thought about us. He's thought about how to resolve the problems that we've been facing for so many years. For me, Lula is a positive person. He's like a friend. He's like a friend of the forest peoples. He wants to save the life of my Yanomami people and to save the lives of our rivers, our forest. He is a very good thinker. He has planned thinking. He has promised to remove the miners from the Yanomami territory. He has also promised to minimize the deforestation of the Amazon forest. So he is following through on his word. He is the only president who has been elected on the ticket of helping the forest peoples, helping the indigenous people of Brazil and other persons who really need help. So he was very good. He went to visit us in Boa Vista on January 21st. He went to Boa Vista to see up close, to meet our children who are suffering malnutrition, illness, and hunger. So he really went there to get a close-up look in order to figure out what he's going to do. That is the positive work that he's doing against the illegal miners who have been destroying our rivers, killing our fish, and allowing for the expansion of malaria, flu, parasites, and other diseases. that have been brought in by the illegal miners and which are destroying our health. So I am a friend of him. I've known him for a long time. He already resolved other situations, such as the Raposa Serra do Sol. So he is continuing to help us, Yanomami in Boa Vista. We really need him.
Can you talk about what this raiding of the illegal gold miners by the government, what actually has taken place? How is the government cutting off their supplies to allow them to devastate the area of the Yanomami?
Well, let me explain. I'm going to explain about the removal of the invaders who engaged in illegal mining. They have been here for a long time, practically 8 years. During that time, no government has ever paid us any attention. So the president of Brazil, he is fulfilling the role that he promised he would. He has sent security forces, federal police, IBAMA, the environmental agency. And this is all tied in with the Amazon forest, our land, but he is expelling them. The miners should not be there. The miners who are there to take the wealth of this land, well, that's because they don't have land to work on. The government of Brazil has not given these miners any place to work in their own place. And my Yanomami people have been living here for many years, and they've come and are doing illegal work. No authority has allowed the miners to cause damage to our rivers and to our health, the health of our people, our traditional people. And not everyone speaks Portuguese. And the disease doesn't come by itself. The disease comes with illegal mining. The illegal mining is not going to bring any good benefit to my Yanomami people. They have just brought disease to kill my people, to leave my people sick and hungry. Wherever the illegal miners work, they're not taking care of my people. The miners are bringing disease. And the miners leave, but the disease stays. Disease has no border. There's no way to get rid of the disease. The miners leave, they go home, and they leave in their wake a dirty land, dirty water, pollution, and the disease will remain as well. It doesn't go away straight away. So the Brazilian government is trying to resolve the problem. The problem is going to continue mistreating my people. So the miners are also exploited by the rich. They're sent by the authorities who have money. I want to say the miners are never going to get rich taking out my gold and killing my people, my brothers and sisters and children.
You mentioned disease that the Yanomami people face, that the illegal gold miners bring in, but it's also mercury contamination. This issue of the use of mercury for gold mining needed to extract the gold, over 90% of the Yanomami have mercury levels in a number of communities that are far higher than the World Health Organization recommends. Mercury is not found natively in the area. Can you talk about the effects of mercury poisoning on the children, on the Yanomami people, adults as well?
I'm going to explain. I don't know, or our forest peoples don't know of any illegal miner who doesn't use mercury. Mercury causes illness in one's body. Mercury is poison. You can't eat mercury. You don't eat mercury. It harms our health. So everyone knows that mercury isn't food. Mercury isn't water. Mercury is not for eating. Mercury, which you're asking about, well, the miners who work without mercury aren't going to get the gold. They place the mercury where the gold is to separate it out, to clean it. And then the mercury stays in the water. And we, the community, we're downriver. The community is by the river's edge. So the Yanomami draw their water from the river for cooking, to drink, and for bathing. Our children like to bathe. Everyone likes to bathe, so they bathe. And then the mercury remains in their hair. It also enters through the ears and the eyes. Children, adults, and the elders are also getting mercury poisoning, not just the children. Adults are getting mercury poisoning as well. So mercury is a business for other countries. It comes from far away, I think from Japan and elsewhere, where they began to use mercury. And then now it's killing my indigenous people. So they continue to use mercury. People are going to cook and drink water, and it's dirty water. The only thing is it goes flows through the rivers in the Yanomami area. The mining is at the headwaters. The rivers that are contaminated are the Katrimani, the Apiayu, the Mukajai, and the Uraricuera. And it also impacts the Orinoco River in Venezuela and in the Yanomami region as well, in the Maturaca. There's water that originates in the mountains, and that's where the miners are, at the headwaters in the mountains. And so mercury is harming our rivers, the rivers from which we drink water. That's what I wanted to explain for you to understand. And also, those of you who live in the cities, you're not drinking contaminated water. No. So that is very bad. It's very bad. And believe me, it's causing serious harm to our rivers. And as you say, it is a crime. Killing the forest, contaminating the rivers, contaminating our fish, and our children are contaminated by mercury. The children's hair is beginning to fall out. The illegal mining in the Yanomami territory is mistreating my people, my indigenous people. That never happened. We had never seen disease like this, where it's so hard to heal. The mercury is going to continue in the holes that they have made, and it's going to create more illness. This is what the miners leave behind in causing this harm to our planet Earth.
Davi Kopanawa Yanomami, the new justice minister, has begun an investigation into the Bolsonaro government for crimes against humanity or crimes of genocide against the Yanomami people. Do you think Bolsonaro should be charged with genocide?
Eu gostaria muito.
I would like that very much. I would like that very much. The Minister of Justice wants to prosecute him because of the way in which my Yanomami people have been mistreated, and they have allowed disease to come in. They've allowed us to die. They've allowed 577 of our children to die. So you, or the role of the Minister of Justice, that's who decides. I'm not going to decide, because the crime that he created against my Yanomami people, well, it's the federal constitution that says that it is criminal to carry out genocide. So he could go to jail so that he could learn to respect my people, so he could learn to respect the cultural heritage of my people and of all Brazil.
Davi Kopanawa Yanomami, leader and shaman for the Yanomami people, one of the largest indigenous tribes in Brazil. He won the Right Livelihood Award in 2019 with the Hutucara Yanomami Association. We spoke to him last Thursday, just as Brazilian President Lula was coming to Washington to meet with President Biden. The meeting came just over a month after supporters of Brazil's former president, far-right Jair Bolsonaro, attempted a coup by violently attacking the Supreme Court and the Brazilian Congress in Brazil's capital, Brasilia. This week, Bolsonaro announced plans to return to Brazil in March to lead the opposition. He's been living in Florida since December. We'll be posting our full interview with Davi Kopanawa Yanomami in Portuguese next week. Happy birthday to Neil Shabata. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
On Monday, February 27, SFE Faculty of Health Sciences and BC Center of Disease Control will be presenting an African Ancestry Project through Zoom. This event will be done through lectures, seminars, and workshops by Alice Mirage, a researcher and PhD candidate with the Faculty of Health Sciences. She will be presenting her research findings from the report on the African Ancestry Project and discuss the impacts of this work on health research. Go to the SFU Black History